I can't stop doing it. Neither can Singapore's top health official.
While I was speaking, I was touching my face. Until Minister Lawrence Wong nudged me with his elbow and said, stop touching your face.
Your face, your hands, and the virus will sort it out. Also today, at the border of Greece and Turkey.
Thousands of migrants have been congregating on the Turkish side trying to get into Greece, and Greek security forces and the migrants on the Turkish side have been clashing over the last week.
Our reporter on that border with the latest. Plus, Iran won't let go of its embassy in Washington.
I did have a client and we tried to buy it. Iran said no, it wasn't for sale.
We go shopping on Embassy Row. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. We begin with news that feels like it's all around us all the time now, the coronavirus. Here's a random question. Are you touching your face right now? Well, stop it. Health officials have been telling us that for weeks. But as the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, stopping is easier said than done.
The person you're most likely to get coronavirus from is yourself. More specifically, your hands. Think of them as sponges soaking up the world and putting it in your eyes and mouth when you touch your face, because you probably touch it all the time. Turns out there's a likely reason why.
Social anxiety.
Psychologist Kevin Chapman, director of the Kentucky Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders, says face touching is often a way to comfort ourselves, but it's not actually good for us.
Although I'll feel better, it ultimately reinforces strong emotional states. So yes, it can be self-soothing, but it also can backfire and make strong emotions worse long term.
Like any good, bad habit, it's hard to stop. And Chapman says all the talk about not touching faces will just make us all want to touch our face.
Having a more flexible thought related to face touching, such as waking up and saying something along the lines of, I will be more aware of touching my face today, is a much more flexible, way less punitive way to extinguish that behavior.
Some people have been able to do it.
And I haven't touched my face in weeks. In weeks.
Mr. President,
I miss it.
Others struggle. Even Singapore's Minister of Health, Gan Kim Yong.
Even at a meeting we have on this ministry task force, while I was speaking, I was touching my face. Until Minister Lawrence Wong nudged me with his elbow and said, stop touching your face.
It's possible people in some cultures might have an easier time stopping than others. Vladimir Alonso is a global health researcher with the University of Sao Paulo, who's contrasted face-touching habits in Brazil and the U.S. And he says he hasn't observed a big difference. Everyone seems to do it almost constantly. But he says some cultures are more touch-oriented in general than others, maybe making the face-touching in those places more dangerous.
Mediterranean people, they, you know, like to greet each other very warmly. So I think that until we have a crisis going on, people keep doing that, you know, saying hello and kissing and hugging and all of that.
Italy's special commissioner for coronavirus has suggested Italians need to tone down their warm culture. France's minister went further, advising people to stop greeting each other with kisses. When German Chancellor Angela Merkel swept into a meeting and offered her hand for a shake to the German interior minister, he waved her away. Normally, that would be rude. These days, it gets a laugh. Online videos demonstrate other alternatives to handshaking, like touching feet or bumping elbows. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said people should take a cue from India and greet each other by putting their palms together and saying namaste. Vladimir Alonso of the University of Sao Paulo says that's good advice, but people should remember they're still touching lots of surfaces that other people have touched after they touched their faces. So he says the best we can hope for now, is just to get people thinking about what they do with their hands.
If we can change some habits that we have, that will be fine. It's going to help.
It might mean we'll be a little more prepared when the next big pandemic sweeps the globe. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Iran has been hit especially hard by the coronavirus. Tehran says it could resort to a halt in travel between major cities. containing the coronavirus there has come with its own unique challenges. Esfandiyar Batmanghulij says that's partly because of U.S. sanctions. Batmanghulij founded Boursin Bazaar, a group that tracks Iran's economy. He says sanctions have caused shortages of healthcare products and shipping delays on things like surgical masks and testing kits.
The challenge is that Iran is in many ways kind of a lead indicator of what could be a more global problem as supply chains come under greater strain because of disruptions related to responses aimed at limiting the spread of the virus.
I heard reported a couple of weeks ago that early on in the outbreak of the coronavirus, Iran had sent, in a humanitarian spirit, about 1 million face masks to China, but then it started growing in Iran and they needed face masks they didn't have in. Did China send back like 250,000 face masks to help them?
That is right. So then you've had this sort of strange, bizarre kind of situation where then China is sending over face masks that it has since produced. And, you know, it becomes a kind of dark symbolism for globalization, how it works in that, you know, supply chains are really complicated. A good can transfer across a border multiple times before you end up with a finished item.
The Trump administration has said it would help Iran with the outbreak. What would that look like in a time of sanctions?
I think there are a few things that concretely they could do. For example, they could clear up the definitional issue. Respiratory masks or contamination suits, those are more difficult to describe as purely humanitarian products. And it requires a bit of interpretation on the part of, let's say, the bank that is considering whether or not to facilitate the transaction. And whenever there's interpretation around a U.S. sanctions question, more often than not, the bank will decide that it's simply not worth it, even if there's a humanitarian benefit. Any situation in which the trade with Iran is more difficult than, let's say, trade with another country that has an acute need for some of these goods, let's say Italy, you know, most of these institutions, financial institutions, or the suppliers, the companies that make these goods, are just going to favor the trade that's easier to do. And so Iran is sort of left in a lurch there.
And then, Esfandiyar, there is INSTEX, the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchanges. INSTEX is an alternative trade mechanism used by Iran. Does INSTEX come into play here?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, the role of INSTEX is that because of the problem where you have very few banks in Europe that are willing to accept payments from Iran, INSTEX allows trade to be conducted without the need for a cross-border financial transaction. Generally speaking, I think as we see this problem move into, you know, its first few months and it becomes more of a long-term issue, some of those vulnerabilities in terms of trade that affect domestic production in Iran could be assuaged through the use of INSTEX, which has been quite delayed in becoming operational. But, you know, it's yet to be seen whether or not it can be an effective tool for helping to address the needs of Iran's public health sector.
I'm curious, too, what you just generally think about how the Iranian government is responding to COVID-19. There's been travel limited between major cities. The government's also urged people not to use paper money, all in an effort to contain the virus.
You know, when the government had an indication that the coronavirus had arrived, they failed to transparently communicate that to the public. They failed to take steps similar to those that have been taken in Italy to impose a quarantine in sort of the epicenter right at the beginning. That being said, I think that that political failure or that failure of governance should be distinguished from what appears to be an incredibly brave and committed response by Iran's doctors and medical professionals who are really quite well qualified. Iran has a well-developed healthcare system, and they have really been in the trenches and have earned a lot of praise and appreciation from the Iranian public. But there's no doubt that this is an incredibly serious situation. I think there is a bit more, let's say, hope that because of the effectiveness of Iran's doctors and nurses, the treatment of the outbreak will be more effective than the failure to contain the outbreak. And ultimately, that's something that I believe is going to become the more important question in a lot of places.
Esfandiyar Batmanghulij is the founder of Boursin Bazaar, which tracks Iran's economy. He's been speaking with us about the effect of U.S. sanctions on the coronavirus outbreak in Iran. Esfandiyar, thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Jack the Ripper had it good, you could say. The guy terrorized London in the late 19th century. He was a cold-blooded murderer, and yet he's become something of a popular villain today, kind of like Billy the Kid. But now some people want to reframe the story of Jack the Ripper. Here's the world's Amanda McGowan.
When it comes to grisly serial killers, you cannot get more notorious than Jack the Ripper.
In the autumn of 1888, London's huge metropolis was gripped by fear.
There's been so many films, TV shows, and even fictionalized accounts of his crimes. Michael Caine starred in this 1980s miniseries, though not as the Ripper himself, by the way.
So terrible was the savagery that the world remembers it still. Jack the Ripper.
And today in London, Jack the Ripper is big business. Visit Whitechapel, the neighborhood he once terrorized, and you can hop on a walking tour to see the killer's lurid crimes. You'll learn about the unsolved murders, the mutilations. You can play detective with evidence and suspects, and even see the gruesome crime scene photos. But there's one thing you might not learn that much about.
Most people don't know the real stories about the victims, nor do people really recognize that they were real people.
That's Hallie Rubenhold. She's a historian and author of the book The Five. It's a biography of Jack the Ripper's five known victims. Rubenhold is working to install a permanent mural in Whitechapel honoring them.
Putting the five women that he killed right back in the center of Whitechapel, where they belong, is a type of restorative justice, I think, and it certainly means we can't ignore them.
Their names were Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly. Rubenhold says that over the years, the Jack the Ripper story has gone from fact to fiction. The conventional wisdom is that all five women were sex workers, picked up by the killer while they were soliciting at night. But Rubenhold's research cast doubt on that story. Her conclusions are controversial in the Ripperology community, but she says only the final victim, Mary Jane Kelly, fits the popularized description.
And the others had lived very long lives by the standards of the day. They were in their 40s and they had become alcoholics. They'd had a number of really bad circumstances direct their lives, and they were by and large homeless.
Rubenhold isn't the only one trying to recenter these stories. Katie Wignall is a tour guide for Look Up London. She runs a walking tour of Whitechapel too, but hers is a little different. She calls it the feminist Jack the Ripper tour.
Really, for me, it was to move completely away from the murders, from speculating on who might have committed the crimes, and really to focus on life, not just of the most famous five victims of Jack the Ripper, but also about the lives of women in the East End.
Her tour highlights stories about the neighborhood that aren't about murder and death.
We talk about a group of women who led a successful strike in the same year, 1888. So it nicely contrasts with this idea of women as just victims in the 19th century.
Her tour talks about Jack the Ripper, but she says it also shows a more dynamic historical portrait of Whitechapel. And that's Hallie Rubenhold's hope, too, with the mural. She doesn't think any of the more conventional Ripper tours should be canceled or banned. But she says over the years, the story has become all about him. And by tipping the scales toward the victims, there is a lot that can be learned.
True crime can tell us about the victim, too. True crime can give us an understanding of the society in which a murder took place and can give us a long view of why they happened, why they still happen, could they happen again. You know, it can be very thought-provoking and very educational.
Now she'll be meeting with the local council to try to make the mural happen. For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
Anti-government protesters in Lebanon have used music, dancing, and social media to keep their movement energized. Now a new tactic, public shaming of government officials. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. In Lebanon, anti-government demonstrators have flooded the streets since last fall. They're doing more than just making noise about corruption in their government, though. Protesters have embraced another tactic, confronting current and former government officials directly. Rebecca Collard has our story from Beirut.
When Lebanon's former prime minister, Fouad Sinoura, went to a Christmas concert at the American University in Beirut, he got a nasty surprise. Dozens of people in the audience started taunting the former leader, chanting, "Revolution, revolution." "Sinoura, get out," they continued. At first, Sinoura and his entourage of relatives and bodyguards stayed put, ignoring the crowd. But pretty soon, almost everyone in the concert hall was on their feet, Eventually, Senora got up from his front row seat and left. And like that, a man who once led the country was forced out of one of Lebanon's most prestigious institutions. This spontaneous act sparked a campaign against Lebanon's elites that has pushed more than a dozen political leaders out of restaurants, malls, and other venues in the past 3 months. Lebanon is teetering on the edge of financial collapse, unable to pay its national debts. The national currency, the lira, is in free fall. Banks have implemented strict capital controls, limiting cash withdrawals and foreign transfers. The price of food and other daily necessities is rising quickly, and people are angry. Protesters have been in the streets here since October, demonstrating against corruption, government mismanagement, and the sectarian political system. They say the crisis was created by the very politicians they're now chasing out of public places. Former Prime Minister Senora, for example, is accused of stealing $11 billion during his time in office. Lebanon's politicians are often criticized for their lavish lifestyles and spending, especially while the country sinks deeper into crisis. When former Foreign Minister Gibran Basile showed up by private jet at the World Economic Forum in Davos this year, he faced a barrage of questions about how he could afford such a luxury.
Ministers make about $5,000 a month. How does one charter a plane on $5,000 a month?
Not one Lebanese lira on the expense of the Lebanese treasury.
The public shaming campaign relies on crowdsourcing. When someone spots a politician somewhere, they send a message to an Instagram account called Thawra Map or Revolution Map. Within minutes, an alert is sent out and a red star shows up on a Google map. And activists descend on that location.
So I've just got this notification saying urgent that there's a minister at a restaurant called Zulu, and we're going to go down there and see what's happening.
By the time I arrive, Fadi Jarizati, Lebanon's former minister of the environment, is gone. Patrons at the cafe are watching videos online of the ousting they just saw live.
It's happening more and more, and you know, the guys of the revolution, they have in heads not to let any one of the politicians get out of home.
A man in his 60s sitting outside with friends watched the confrontation. He only wants to be identified as
a Lebanese citizen.
You are not welcome here.
In the video, the protesters confront Jarizati. It starts with a civilized but heated conversation about his time as Minister of the Environment. Lebanon's environment is in a dire state. Water is unsafe to drink, the sea is too dirty to swim in, and air pollution is way too high for a country with almost no industry. This confrontation in itself is a victory for protesters. They have the rare opportunity to confront a politician face to face. Things get more heated and the minister leaves.
Before they find a solution to our country, they should stay home. Then they go out with the solution. And we accept everything, but they should have a solution. We are in a deep shit in this country.
Another bystander says she has mixed feelings about the tactic of public shaming.
I mean, we can kick them out every single day, but nothing's going to change.
Well, I mean, it seems like they're going out less.
They should. It's impossible not to. So, but I think something more should happen. I definitely think something more extreme measures have to be taken.
The Instagram account behind the shaming campaign is doing just that. It's putting out information about businesses owned by politicians and their home addresses. And fewer politicians dare to venture out. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
Nearly 300 million kids have been told to stay home from school. 22 countries have shut down some classes due to the coronavirus. Earlier this week, we spoke with some teachers and parents about it. Now, we're going to let the kids have a say. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
In India's capital, New Delhi, primary schools are now shut down until the end of the month. Teresa asked her 8-year-old son, Shreyas, what he thought about that.
I feel pretty good. I can play with my friends right now.
You think you will be only playing, or is there anything else you'll be doing in your time?
Yes, watching TV.
It's kind of adorable how he's totally missing his mom's point that maybe he could keep up with his schoolwork too.
You think you'll miss school?
No, never.
6-year-old Giorgio in Rome is on the same page. Schools in Italy closed down yesterday.
I love staying at home with my mommy.
I asked Giorgio how he was keeping himself busy in addition to playing with mommy. He said he was doing homework and walking his dog. And his 4-year-old sister Emma wanted to add this footnote.
Come si dice in inglese, mi piace.
I love my doggy.
I love my doggy and I love stay at home with my brother.
Oh. It's been a bit more trying for kids in China, which was the first country to suspend classes. 4-year-old Leo in Shanghai has been off since January 17th, and he really misses school. To ease the pain of separation a little, Leo's school lets kids call in 2 to 3 times a week to leave messages for each other and their teachers. This preschooler is saying, I really want to go back to school soon. All the messages sound like that. It kind of breaks your heart. In Tokyo, schools have been closed for about a week, and the local parks are filled with kids. But middle schooler Mika isn't going out much. She's focused on self-betterment.
It's like small goals they've like pushed away over time that now you have time to do. So I've been trying to learn to play a certain song on the piano. I feel like going out with my friends is a waste of like this whole closing school.
Why?
Because the goal was to reduce large get-togethers and like
just need to be a large get-together.
It doesn't need to be a large get-together, says the exasperated older sister in high school, Leia. Somewhat ironic coming from you, says the younger sister.
Okay, well, what you do is a large get-together, so.
And remember, this is not a quarantine. Also, Leia isn't ignoring her schoolwork entirely. In fact, she has some advice for other kids who have to stay home from school.
Staying home is going to be a real test of your self-control, so don't slack off.
Hear that, kids? This is not a vacation. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
News headlines are coming up next. You're with The World. As coronavirus gets real, an emergency planner tells us what mass-scale preparation really looks like.
How do you make sure that utilities continue to work if a lot of your staff are away? How do you make sure that food is still available?
I'm Marco Werman, planning for the pandemic. That's still ahead here on The World. It's not yet been declared a pandemic, but COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, hit a grim mark today, 100,000 cases worldwide. That is confirmed across more than 80 countries. Still, the World Health Organization is stressing the virus is not out of control, but the organization's head, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said all countries should make containment their highest priority.
We continue to call on countries to find, test, isolate, and care for every case and to trace every contact.
Ghebreyesus called on nations to act with speed, scale, and determination.
Countries have been planning for scenarios like this for decades. Now is the time to act on those plans.
Jane Halton has worked on those plans. She's a former chair of the executive board of the WHO and the former health secretary of Australia. In December, she was part of a study with Johns Hopkins University that gamed out responses, not to COVID-19, but to an imaginary virus.
It would seem eerily prescient at one level, but in truth, of course, we do understand in the broad terms how these events pan out. We understand that if you don't manage to control spread early, the impact is greater. We also understand that if you don't slow it down, you will have much more negative impact on the economy and on society.
So the WHO is saying we're not in full pandemic mode yet. It's not giving up on the containment of the spread of COVID-19. So what does containing the disease actually mean?
Well, containment of the disease means you actually control and limit its spread. In other words, it doesn't spread to all corners of the globe. And it is still the case if you look geographically. When you try to contain, what you try to do is eliminate that virus in that community. You don't let it run its natural course, which would be, of course, a much higher attack rate. Many more people would get it than if you managed to contain it. So when the Director General of the WHO rightly says we're not, and it's a technical thing as to whether we're in pandemic or not, but we don't have universal and widespread yet. And I mean, I think all people who work in public health would hope that we could contain and therefore minimise the impact of this disease. But it's a big task, and I don't think any of us should underestimate how difficult that task is.
In these gamed out scenarios, though, how does coronavirus end, or the imaginary virus that you were using?
Well, in the gamed out scenarios, I mean, essentially you end up with many hundreds of thousands of people who have died. And I mean, I think this is the thing to understand, that in that scenario, the numbers that you care about are, one, how many people get the disease, two, how many of them are seriously ill, and then also what is the death rate. So obviously, a death rate of, say, 1% on a disease which doesn't impact very many people is not going to result in many deaths, and also is not going to result in your health system being overwhelmed by all the people who need intensive care or ventilation at the one time. If, however, you have a huge number of people, say 30% of the population would get this virus, and particularly if they get it at the same time, then you end up with many more people needing hospital care. And most countries don't have idle hospital care available, idle intensive care available. And so therefore you end up with many more deaths. And in that scenario, as is the case with all diseases, eventually, the scenario that we gamed in New York, eventually that came to an end. And ultimately, of course, you end up with pharmaceutical interventions. By that, I mean treatments and a vaccine. And so you can then bring it under control. But it is undoubtedly the case that you end up with many, many, many deaths. And depending on the level of spread with this disease, that is the risk that we're all confronting.
And what comes after containment itself?
Basically, you try to minimize the impact. But what you're effectively doing with containment in the post-containment period is you're actually trying to buy the time to actually develop the vaccine 12 to 18 months. And the thing we need to remember, even when we get that vaccine developed, we have to produce it. And we have to actually think about where the priority is for that vaccine. So post-containment is, we hope, a world where we do have pharmaceutical interventions and other treatments available, which means because these diseases will continue to circulate, we will know that. Once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't get it back in, but we need to be in a position where we can manage it much more effectively.
So, are you implying that COVID-19 is here forever? It's here to stay?
It will be surprising if we ever completely eliminate this virus.
Finally, Jane Halton, if you don't mind me asking, how have you prepared for yourself, for your family? Are you doing any flying?
No, I will concede that I am not flying. And I am pretty much grounded in Australia until the bulk of this passes. I mean, there's two reasons for that, and not necessarily that I have a particular personal concern about my own safety, but I'm also worried about the notion of one being stuck somewhere, but also the impact that I might have if I pass the disease on to somebody who is very vulnerable. And we know, particularly for older people and people with comorbidities, other diseases and illnesses that make them vulnerable if they become ill. And I think everyone's got a responsibility not just to think about themselves, but also other people in the community and their loved ones.
Jane Halton, former chair of the World Health Organization's Executive Board, thank you very much.
It was a complete pleasure. Thank you.
Let's turn now to a border where migrants are stuck, a common refrain these days. But in this case, we're talking about the border between Greece and Turkey. Turkey opened the door to Europe, allowing passage to migrants. Greece is one of the first places they go, but the Greek authorities don't want them. And Turkish police are now trying to prevent them from returning to Turkey. The World's Lydia Emanalidou is on the Greek side of that border.
That border on land is about 120 miles. I drove more than half of it today, and I ended up in the small village of Castanyes. That's where you have an official border crossing point, and it's where thousands of migrants have been congregating on the Turkish side trying to get into Greece.
Right, and it's also the same crossing point that EU officials visited earlier this week to just assess the situation, right?
That's correct. And over the last week, the Greek government has really stepped up the security here. There's a lot of police, a lot of military presence. You know, just walking around, I saw big police buses, you know, with bars on the windows. Migrants who get arrested end up being put in them. I saw this really big army truck with a lot of barbed wire on it. You know, they could put additional barbed wire on the fences. And in fact, Frontex, the European Border and Coast Guard Agency, is also sending people here to help Greek authorities in the coming days.
So we've seen on social media videos and pictures of scenes of real chaos along that border. Were you able to verify any of that?
No one besides the police and the army are actually allowed to get up really close to the point where we've seen all the action, as you said. I met a wheat farmer who has a plot of land right by the border fence, and he was actually nice enough to take me there. Technically, you know, people aren't allowed there, but because he has a plot of land there, we were able to go and get up close. Mm. And I was actually able to see the thousands of people, not from too close, but, you know, from I was able to see the thousands of people we've been seeing on social media lined up along the border. And, you know, while we were there, there was tear gas being thrown from the Turkish side to the Greek side. Later on in the evening, both sides started firing blanks at each other. You know, the Greek government says that was for deterrence.
So tear gas being launched from the Turkish side of the border, Turkey's blaming Greece for the violence, saying Greek forces are injuring and even killing some migrants. How are the Greek authorities responding to that?
The Greek government has categorically denied that. They say that this is propaganda coming from Turkey and that they're just trying to keep the situation under control. But they deny having killed or injured any migrants in the process. Greek authorities also say that, you know, over the last week, they've stopped more than 35,000 people who have tried to get in, and they've arrested a few hundred people who did make it through the border.
Lydia, what have locals told you about what they're seeing and how they feel about these tensions right on their doorstep?
One of the people I talked to about this is Fotini Gugulidou. She lives literally down the street from the official border crossing point. She's lived in this village, Castanyes, her whole life. And she said there's never been an issue like this until now.
Σαφώς. Σίγουρα είμαστε αγανακτισμένοι γιατί δεν βλέπουμε ενώ ήρθανε, είπανε.
She told me that she and other locals are really frustrated with EU officials in particular. As you said, they came and visited earlier this week, and she said now she's just waiting to see what happens. You know, the EU has promised to give Greece money to help deal with the situation, and Fotini Gugulidou told me she wants to see that happening. She said that in the meantime, all of this is really affecting people's day-to-day lives, for the people that live there, and especially for the people that have businesses in the area.
What did she tell you about the businesses, Lydia?
So she's saying that, you know, restaurants, hotels, all sorts of businesses are being affected because, you know, as I said, this little village is right by the Turkish border. And so people would go in and out. People from Turkey would come to Greece. People from Greece would go to Turkey. And, you know, that was really interesting to hear because, as you know, Greece and Turkey have a really long history of conflict. And that conflict plays out even today in personal ways between Greeks and Turks. But along this border, there are some real relationships between Greeks and Turkish people. And Fotini Gugulidou told me that's being really impacted because people can't cross, not even legally. The border is completely shut, at least temporarily. And she and other people I talked to told me that they're not angry at the Turkish people. They're angry at the Turkish government.
There was Lydia Manolidou with the latest from the Greek side of the border between Turkey and Greece. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Washington, D.C. is home to dozens of foreign embassies. But when the United States breaks off diplomatic relations with a country, what happens to those buildings on Embassy Row? Consider Iran's real estate in Washington. Reporter Michaela Lafrak took a look at two of Iran's properties in the district.
The two neighboring buildings sit on a high-profile stretch of road here called Embassy Row. It's lined with historic mansions owned by foreign governments. The two in question are both owned by Iran. First is a classic brick mansion. It's the former ambassador's residence. Next door is a white, modernist building with blue tiling on the front and a big blue dome. It used to be the Iranian embassy. They've both been boarded up for years, but they used to be the site of these wild parties. And at the center of the party was always one man.
Hello?
Hello, this is Michaela in Washington.
Yes, Michaela. How are you, dear? I am at your service.
Ardashir Zahedi was the Iranian ambassador to the U.S. in the early 60s and again in the 70s. He lives in Switzerland now.
You know how old I am?
No.
Well, I tell you, but don't tell anyone.
All right.
No, everybody knows. I am 90 years old.
Zahedi oversaw the embassy's design in the early 60s. He wanted it to be a mix of American and Persian styles. One room had a domed ceiling decorated in this incredibly intricate mosaic that would glitter like stars. He'd throw lavish dinners and galas there. We're talking bowls of caviar. Frequent guests included the Nixons, Reagans, Liza Minnelli, Andy Warhol, and
my special girlfriend, Elizabeth Taylor.
Yep, Zahedi dated the actress Elizabeth Taylor.
I remember one time vividly, he put champagne in one of her shoes and drank from it.
This is Hossein Askari. He's Iranian and a professor emeritus of international relations at George Washington University. He knew Zahedi, but he didn't go to the parties, not a scene. But he did read about them in the newspaper. He explains Iran had a ton of oil money back then, and Zahedi got to spend it.
He did have an open checkbook. Money was not an object. Iran had gotten all this money all of a sudden, and it went on a shopping spree.
But then 1979 hit, and the Iranian Revolution happened.
Almost 40,000 refinery workers went on strike today, virtually cutting off Iran's petroleum exports.
There is still a strong sentiment against American interests in Iran.
Every day here now, the demonstrations and arrests go on.
That's from ABC News' coverage of the Iranian Revolution. Students took over the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and held Americans hostage for 444 days. After the hostage crisis was over, the U.S. left its Tehran embassy, and it hasn't gone back. Meanwhile, the nearly dozen Iran-owned properties in cities across the U.S. were abandoned. Zahedi and his fellow diplomats left and never returned. So, quickly, here's how this works. When the U.S. suspends diplomatic relations with a country, the U.S. State Department is legally bound to protect that country's diplomatic properties here. It gets the money for maintenance by renting them out, but it's not allowed to sell them. Real estate agent Bobby Brewster sells a lot of homes in the area, including former embassies. We visited the Iranian ambassador's residence together, and she thinks it could sell for as much as $12 million if Iran would agree to the sale.
I did have a client, and we tried to buy it. Iran said no.
Really?
Absolutely, it wasn't for sale.
The State Department did rent out the residence for a while, but it's been empty for years. When we were there, we saw contractors putting in new windows.
They said they're renovating it now.
The State Department denied my request for an interview and for a tour of the properties, but the contractors confirmed State hired them. Next door, however, the former embassy sits empty.
Can we walk up?
Yeah.
Brewster says it'd be pretty hard to find a tenant for it. It just looks like an embassy, an Iranian embassy. That means it could stay empty until Iran and the U.S. restore diplomatic ties. Michaela Lefrak, Washington, D.C.
Even if it's not for sale, it's still fun to look. Photos of Iran's former embassy are at theworld.org. Serious pot smokers know about Malawi gold. Here is a cannabis grower in a documentary called Strain Hunters talking about the African variety.
This crop, it is rare, just like gold. You can't find it any other way or no. In other country. And this, with just a little, you can fetch much money.
But recreational Malawi gold is illegal to grow and sell in Malawi. It could soon be fair game, though, for industrial and medicinal purposes. That is, if Malawi's president signs a bill on his desk that would free up restrictions. It could give the country a big economic boost. Malawi is among the poorest countries in Africa. Nebert Nerenda used to work in Malawi's Ministry of Finance. In an unusual career move, he dropped that job to grow weed.
Colleagues thought at first that I was joking.
He was not joking. Nerenda knew that tobacco exports were slowing in Malawi. People don't smoke cigarettes like they used to. And he thought cannabis could eventually pick up the slack.
There was a lot of public sector support to develop the tobacco value chain in Malawi. So if that model could be replicated for hemp, I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we would see hemp also being one of the major industrial commercial crops for Malawi.
Right. And your company, Invigrow, is trying to develop industrial hemp as a kind of new cash crop for Malawi. Hemp can be used to make thousands of different products. What are you planning to produce?
Well, we want to start simple food and nutritional products, the textiles, clothing. So that's what we want to show.
So have you already put seeds in the ground and discovered what the challenges are of growing and processing industrial cannabis?
Yes, maybe one of the challenges that we see is the continued awareness to make sure that we demystify the confusion between hemp and the narcotic cousin. Here we call it chamba. There probably you call it marijuana.
So as to the long-held stigma surrounding cannabis as a narcotic, what are you going to do to dispel that stigma?
We'll have to generate a lot of information, and perhaps people will see it and test it. So we'll continue that general awareness through displaying the products that are there, that are good, that have got nothing to do with getting people's minds high.
The president of Malawi, Peter Mutharika, has until March 19th to sign this hemp bill into law. Recreational use is still illegal in Malawi, but there are lots of people, I understand, who consume cannabis anyway, like Malawi Gold. Do the authorities mostly turn the other way?
That is exactly my point, that whether this is signed or assented to by the president as law will have no effect in terms of the people that want to access the recreational drug, because they are already accessing it through their own channels.
Nebert Nirenda is the former principal secretary of Malawi's Ministry of Finance. He's now the director of Invigrow, the first company in Malawi granted authorization to research industrial hemp. Nebert, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're most welcome.
In Mexico, three nurses have unintentionally become heroes in the fight against the coronavirus, thanks to a video that went viral teaching the rest of us how to wash our hands like the real pros. The World's Jorge Valencia has our story.
The three nurses, they're wearing blue scrubs, standing in front of a painting with a serene waterfall, and they're dancing in place. And now we are going to teach you, they sing.
Yo soy la de la orilla derecha.
Xochitl Ruiz Mola tells me that in the video she's the one on the right. And Rosalia Mores Toledo jokes that she is the one shaking her hips the most.
La que mueve más las caderas, dice Xochitl.
And Yesenia Benitez Colón is in the center.
Soy enfermera del hospital de alta especialidad del estado de Oaxaca.
The three of them are nurses at a hospital in Mexico's southern state of Oaxaca. And the video, they made it in Xochitl's house on one of their days off.
Bueno, lo hicimos en conmemoración del Día Internacional del Lavado de Manos.
Xochitl says they did it for Global Handwashing Day. Yes, that is actually a thing.
Sí, sí existe.
It's on October 15th. It's sponsored by Colgate-Palmolive, the London School of Hygiene, and a few others. Management at the hospital in Oaxaca decided to have a contest ahead of the holiday.
Bueno, la idea surgió, yo creo que fue simultáneo, ¿no?
Yesenia says she and her two friends together came up with the idea to make the video.
El beneficio de enfermería es que hay mucho trabajo en equipo.
The good thing about nursing is that you have to work as a team, Yesenia says. The three of them have become good friends. They've been working together for 8 years in the intensive care unit.
El ritmo de la música realmente se me ocurrió a mí. Se me hizo una canción muy pegajosa. En ese tiempo,
Rosalia says she had the idea to use the beat from a song that was already popular. They wrote lyrics spelling out how they wash their hands at the hospital. They follow World Health Organization guidelines. They do it 100 times a day, they say.
Ahí nos vemos super serias, pero a punto de ganarnos la risa, ¿eh? Tardamos.
They barely even smile in the video, but Yesenia says they had to keep on starting over several times because they kept on breaking out in laughter over how silly they felt. The most memorable part, the one hundreds of thousands of people have quoted on the internet, they just improvised it over a section of song they didn't have lyrics for. Muere bacteria, muere. In other words, die bacteria, die. This is representative of mainstream sense of humor in Mexico, says Jacobet Gonzalez. She's a marketing strategist in Mexico City.
We like to take things lightly. It doesn't matter if they're serious topics. We're always trying to look for the funny side of things.
Gonzalez says that when tragedy strikes Mexico, it's only a matter of time before social media is flooded with jokes about it. Even the tragic earthquake from 3 years ago.
Like the memes that came out of it, it's like, it's really a terrible thing that happened, but look, this is funny and it's not that bad anymore, you know?
The nurse's hand-washing video is not the only jingle that has circulated in Mexican media ever since the coronavirus began making international headlines. One guy made a song in which he tells people they should probably stop hanging out with their friends. In another video, the members of a cumbia group toast with Corona beers. I can say for myself that I've changed the way that I wash my hands ever since I saw the nurse's video. So how do the three nurses say that you should wash your hands? They do it in 11 steps. Water, soap, palm to palm, right hand over left hand over right. Actually, just check out the video at theworld.org. Die, bacteria, die. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
Listen to the nurses. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. You all have a relaxing weekend.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.